So I wanted to talk a little this morning about the role of ritual in Soto Zen, and since that's what we're emphasizing in this retreat. And I think it's interesting to note that in Japanese there actually isn't a word that corresponds to our word for ritual. In Japanese, there's a term, gyoji, the word gyoji, which means practices. And practices encompass a lot of, in any kind of practice, it would include zazen, meditation practice. It would include what we might think of as the as meal practice, so the oryoki practice that we'll be learning. It could include teeth brushing. So, you know, you might be thinking, well, you get up in the morning and you wash your face and use the toilet and brush your teeth, and then you're ready to practice meditation. You know, you take care of your body, and then you go to do Zen practice. But there isn't really a boundary on Zen practice. And I think this term gyoji is the idea that everything that we do is included in our practice. And sometimes, I mean, there's all kinds of ways of describing Zen, but one way of describing the entirety of it is to think of it in three parts as precepts, meditation, and wisdom. And those three are really integral. So if you emphasize one and leave one out, for example, if you leave out the practice of precepts, which some people have done, some teachers have not really emphasized that, at some point along the line, they tend to get into difficulty. So ethical practices prepare one for meditation, and the practice of wisdom would be the study of the scriptures and study of, in particular, understanding emptiness and impermanence. And then meditation is really, in this sense, I would think of it as this word gyoji of practices that encompasses meditation in a very broad sense, including sitting meditation, walking meditation, standing meditation, the meditation of washing your face, and the meditation of eating meals, and so forth. So all of these things are part of practice, and that's what I hope to look at in this retreat. And some of you may have come to Zen thinking that it was a very nice, simple practice. I know I've spoken with many people who said that they were attracted to Zen because it didn't seem very religious to them. Maybe some of you have had that experience of going into a meditation hall and just kind of black and white simplicity as opposed to a lot of religious symbolism and iconography and so forth. But actually that's only part of it. So there's more that you may not have been introduced to as yet, and it may be a little bit of a shock. And in fact, I think many people have been shocked, for example, in going to Japan and going to a traditional Zen temple and seeing that, oh, actually, there is a lot of stuff there. That, you know, there's beautiful fabrics and brocades and things hanging from the ceiling. And, it does actually look, it's not so simple. It's not just plain black and white and with one Buddha, but many, many Buddha figures and different objects on the altar. So I think partly our idea in the West of Zen is just a result of how Buddhism was transmitted, you know, particular historical circumstances. So the early Japanese scholars, or a number of people who first introduced Zen to the West, were not actually priests. In particular, D.T. Suzuki was not an ordained priest, and then in the West there was Alan Watts, who was not a priest. But these were people who were really responsible for popularizing Zen in the earlier generation. And they didn't bring over all these forms. They really de-emphasized that aspect of Zen and really presented it as a kind of maybe a philosophy or psychology or a mystical experience that was detached from religion. And at that time, that idea was also popular in Japan, because during the Meiji period, the Buddhist Church, which was really the very closely connected to the government in Japan. So this is another thing that we're not used to in the West, to have a church that's very closely connected with the government in terms of carrying out their policies and so forth, and having government regulations that people had to register as members of some church. So the Buddhist Church was very closely tied to the earlier regime, and there was a reaction against that. And in the Meiji period, there really was this turning away from that kind of tie with the government, and wanting to present Zen as a kind of pure religion that went back to what was known as the golden age of the Tang Dynasty in China. So many of you may have read histories of Japanese or Chinese Buddhism that talk about the golden age in China, which modern scholars think is actually a myth. So I myself have found that the history of Zen isn't as simple as maybe we thought at one time. It seemed very straightforward that there was this golden age in China in the 8th and 9th century, and these wonderful iconoclastic Zen masters like Matsu and Baijiang, who broke all the rules and worked with koans, with their students, and did kind of crazy enlightened things, and that was then transmitted to Japan. And it turns out that it's actually not quite that simple, that there is a background in China of actual very very detailed, worked out monastic practices. And you can, there now is a wonderful translation of the early Chan monastic rules that's available in English. And you can read how the details of, like, how you enter the hall, how you walk to your seat, how you sit down, how you get up on the raised platform, how services are conducted, how you take meals, and so forth. So later, Dogen Zenji in the 13th century wrote monastic rules for Eheiji, and they're taken very closely from these earlier rules in China, sometimes almost word for word from the earlier rules. So there had been this Japanese idea that, as I said, about this golden age, and that later Buddhism in China degenerated, that earlier, so the picture is that earlier you have these kind of crazy Zen masters who had broken all the rules and were doing, you know, putting shoes on their head and doing all kinds of crazy things, and that later there was a degeneration into a more rigid structure of very detailed kind of rules and regulations. And the Japanese attempt was to show that it was the earlier version, this so-called pure Zen, that was transmitted to Japan. And it turns out that that actually is not really accurate, that there's no reason to think that there was that big of a change in China. So probably it's more like there always were these monastic rules, which were actually heavily influenced, if not taken from Confucianism and from the Chinese court, which had very very worked out protocol, the Confucian idea of ritual and everyone having a place and people acting in harmony, and that ritual was a way of ordering oneself in relationship to others and in relationship to the natural world, that these ideas were then taken into the Buddhist monasteries, and that it's against that background of rules and regulations that people were able to do crazy things. So if you think about it, breaking the rules really only makes sense if there are rules to break. If you don't have a very clear structure, then unusual actions don't have any meaning. There's nothing to compare it to. So it's only when you have ritual and structure that people can then break those rules and do something different. So Dogen talks about that also, about there not being a need for offering incense and chanting sutras and so forth. But he said that to people who were doing that every day. So against the background of that's what everyone is doing, then you can talk about doing something different, and it makes sense. So so we have that, as I said, when Buddhism, or when Zen was first brought to the West, the monastic rules were not emphasized, and I think people felt that, at least in the United States, people were really interested in, everyone wants to be free. Everyone wants to be free, and thinking of freedom as freedom from the rules. But I think the idea in Zen is that there's freedom to be found within following the certain procedures, and that when you have those procedures, then you can actually see what you're doing. So that acts as a kind of mirror and a way of understanding yourself. So the point of having particular ways of doing things is not so that everyone will be the same, but so that we can actually see how everyone is different. And you might even think of it like in a ballet, there are descriptions for, I think there are actually, I don't know anything about ballet, maybe some of you know better, but my idea is that you can describe a way of dancing and or a certain position, and everyone learns how to do that, but then there's something about a great ballet dancer that transcends that form. But first you have to learn the form. You don't just say, well, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And it's when everyone is really intending and has studied the same form that then actually the way that it's done, the person's true individuality is shown in very, very, very subtle ways. So even though we may all, like yesterday, we talked about how to hold your hands and gassho, yet each of you does it differently. So in trying to do that form, can you express exactly who you are? Can you put your whole body and mind into just simply bringing your palms together and bowing? Or is there something missing there? You know, do you feel you have to do something different in order to express who you are? Can you do it just in that form? So that's part of the challenge of working with these forms. And so this morning, let's see, we're actually trying to fit an awful lot into a short time. And yesterday I think I very rashly asked if there were people who wanted even additional training. And that may not be realistic, because I think all of you are going to be getting a huge amount. And if there's anyone who feels there isn't getting enough, let me know. And or if you have a specific interest, let me know and we'll see what we can do. So we're going to do some Oryoki practice, and maybe I'll just talk about that a little bit before we go and do it. So Oryoki is a bowl which is just enough. So having just enough food to eat. And of course the origin is, if you can read in the early suttas, that in the morning the Buddha would take up his eating bowl and go into town and ask for alms. And the other monks would do so also, with the instruction being just to hold out your bowl and accept whatever's offered. So don't just seek out rich people, or don't seek out particular kind of food. Just accept whatever you receive. And later this evolved into so in Southeast Asia, I think still one bowl is used and everything is put into that bowl. But in China and then in Japan, it evolved into a set of bowls. And the traditional monks' bowls actually have a set of five, and we've simplified that to have a set of three. And so we've prepared for each of you a set of bowls wrapped up in a cloth, and you'll keep that set for the duration of the retreat, receiving your food and then cleaning the bowl at the end and putting it away and having it there for the next meal. And the traditional practice in Soto Zen would be to eat in the meditation hall. So if we had, and usually they're raised platforms, so if we were able to do that here, after Zazen, we would have service, and then you simply sit back down in your seat, open up the bowls, and then servers would come in with food and serve each person. And then after that, the servers would go and have their meal a little less formally. And so that's the form that we're going to use, so that we can all eat together, rather than dividing you into a group of people who would serve other people. We'll all be doing it together. And so there's chanting before receiving the food, before opening the bowls, before receiving the food, and at the end. So there's quite a bit of chanting. And generally we find that in a completely formal meal would take close to an hour, out of which you would have 5 or 10 minutes to actually eat. And the rest of the time is the opening and closing and chanting and washing the bowls and so forth. So, but generally that amount of time is really all it takes to eat. So usually our meal times are taken up with maybe socializing and talking and daydreaming. You know, the actual eating time for a simple meal is really not so long. And so you do have to eat, I don't know, maybe a little bit faster for some of you than you may be used to. But it's an opportunity to really pay attention to your eating. And I think you'll find that if you just eat, that you'll actually have enough time to eat. So mindfulness doesn't necessitate going slowly. If you take out all the gaps of daydreaming, than just eating and paying attention. I think often people find that our yogi meals are always delicious. And the reason why they're delicious is because you're actually paying attention. You're actually having the opportunity to just notice how the food tastes. And you don't need to be doing anything else at that time. So I think maybe it's time for a few questions, and then we will need to go and actually do it. Does anyone want to bring anything up? Yes, Melvin.
Just a question about when we approach our cushion and the bowing. If somebody sat down already, are we bowing with the person who's just arriving?
Oh, yes, that's a good point. Yes, so when, if you're sitting and person comes and bows next to you, you can bow in greeting with that person.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and so you may notice just out of the corner of your eye, people bowing on either side.
And are we doing it across as well? So the person bows to the cushion and
well, if you're already sitting, you probably won't. So you don't need to be trying to see behind yourself at that point. So I think just people on either side would be good.
Thank you.
Anything else? Yes.
You referred a couple of times to Buddhism as a religion. But is it a religion? I mean, there's no God. So how can one have a religion without some kind of deity?
I don't know if Buddhism is a religion or not. I think it depends on how you want to define religion. So if you define religion as a belief system based on a creator deity, then Buddhism would not qualify. So you might say the way of the Buddha or the way of Zen. So I think it's always, you know, we have this difficulty of kind of matching up a Western way of thinking with an idea that doesn't necessarily fit into even our language. And so it's, yeah, it depends on how you would want to define religion in that way. Yeah. Yeah, don't worry, I'm not trying to pop a god in there. That, by the way, there's something you didn't know about. That,
Oh, on the notice board.
Right, thank you. So if you'd like to meet with me privately rather than the, rather than having a sign-up sheet, so Joanne is serving as my jisha or attendant, ceremonial attendant, so you can, is a note on the board the best way for you?
Or just
you can
say to me.
Either just let her know, or if you don't see her, leave her a note on the board, and then she will organize that and let you know. And also I understand that there are several people who are sewing raksus, or the Buddha's robe, the informal version of this. And I thought I could meet with those people this afternoon at 4. So if you are one of those people who are sewing, bring your, I'm not sure where, maybe if the library has tables?
Yeah.
So if the library is available, that might be a good place to meet at 4. So bring your I assume you have some supplies. Bring everything with you at that time. Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, so if for some reason you would like to not come to anything that's listed on the schedule, could you please leave a note on the board? So there's one period that's listed as optional, so if you're not coming to that period, you don't need to write anything. But if there's some reason why you need to miss another period, please do let me know what's happening with you and what your plan is. Okay? So at this point, so we have closing verses, which we will recite together, and then we'll go to the dining hall and do some oryoki practice. May your intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit.